Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Friday night edition of the Anaheim Calling podcast. First podcast of the week, I believe.
Something like that. I think we did one Sunday. It's been a while.
So the Ducks just played their last game before a long 9-day layoff, and we're coming off a bit of a layoff of our own. But yeah, we've got a lot to talk about. We've got three whole games to cover. The Ducks played the Blues earlier this week. That did not go very well. They lost 4-1. Then two back-to-back wins. Their first back-to-back set of wins since November 1st. A 4-2 victory over the Nashville Predators last night in Nashville, and then an exciting 2-1 win in overtime against the Carolina Hurricanes tonight. Impressive to me that they were able to reel off two wins back-to-back on the road against one, shall we say, competitive team in Nashville, and then good team in Carolina.
I think with Nashville, what you can say is it's a team that has
they're a team
came into the season having Stanley Cup aspirations.
They're a team. What's the famous Pierre Dorion quote from that press conference? The Senators GM, they ask him, "What do you like about your team?" Well, we're a team.
I forgot about that quote. That is a good one.
Yeah,
I think, or a bad one, depending on how you view it.
I think, if you're firing Peter Laviolette for John Hines, I don't know.
I mean, that's better than firing Gerard Gallant for
Pete DeBoer.
But if you want to hear our talk about that, go check out our Patreon episode.
Yes, absolutely. So let's just jump right in. This is going to be a pretty packed episode. We're going to try to be on top of it here. I'm just going to get out of the gate and say it right away. The St. Louis game on Monday was not a game to write home about for Anaheim. They lost 4-1, and that scoreline makes it seem not as bad as the game actually was.
Yeah.
They were outchanced 30-13 at 5-on-5, and from high danger locations, they were outchanced 11-4. Can you label this game as a no-show?
Yeah, and it's now up on the screen, and if you were to look at shot attempts, maybe you could convince yourself that this wasn't horrible. It's bad, but not a complete no-show, because, I mean, granted, the Ducks only did get 22 shot attempts at 5-on-5 in the entire game, but where it gets real bad is when you look at quality. The Ducks allowed 2.16 expected goals against and only generated 0.83, so let's put it like this. If the Ducks would have had an average shooting percentage in this game, they would have scored less than a goal. They should not have scored a goal, basically. So I think that puts everything into perspective for the St. Louis game of how they played. And basically, I mean, you put it best by saying they no-showed. They didn't play well. There was the comedy of errors that happened on the fourth goal with Gibson running into
Hampus Lindholm,
and then just a wide open net. It was just
that was the cherry on the you know what Sunday. That was pretty bad.
Yes.
Although I don't think that was Gibson's fault. I think that was actually completely Lindholm's fault. I don't know why he was trying to go through Gibson when it was pretty clear that Gibson was taking the inside track back to the net. Anyway. One stat of the night that I don't love it, but that I think kind of sums everything up. So Hampus Lindholm and Erik Gudbranson spent 4 minutes together at 5-on-5. In those 4 minutes and 19 seconds, they allowed 10 shot attempts and generated none. And from a scoring chance perspective, they got outchanced as well. So it's just nothing could go right for this team. Now, spinning this forward, because I really don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this game. It was just that bad, and we've got two other games to talk about. This game did prompt some change for Anaheim, though. Because after what has been a really good run for the pairing of Erik Gudbranson and Cam Fowler, we would see new defense pairings against Nashville on Thursday. And I think it makes sense in a way, because although Gudbranson and Fowler have been so good together, I think that Lindholm and Manson, for whatever reason this season, just have not been up to their caliber of play that we've expected, that we've come to expect for so long.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of key there, because one of the big complaints that we had with Carlisle last year was his reluctance to put Manson and Lindholm together, and when they did, they instantly clicked. And this year, they've kind of been there, but not fully. It hasn't really hit the levels that we've seen from them in the past, and that kind of is reflected in the numbers that we have so far this season for them. So I think at a certain point in time, you got to look at just making a change to make a change, to kind of let the guys know that there something different has to happen, especially after such a poor performance. And I think that that is a really good way to go about it, to just try something new. It may not be successful. It more than likely probably isn't successful, because you had some of these pairings at different points in time during the season. You can probably look at the numbers for last season even. But at least you're trying to shake things up a bit there to get a new mix going, get something new going, because at a certain point in time, what else can Dallas Eakins do with this defense? I mean, there really isn't a whole lot. The top four is basically solidified with who's going to be playing and who's going to take up those minutes. So outside of calling up Josh Mahura or calling up Brendan Gulley, this is the group. The bottom pairing is going to be a shuffle of Delzato and Holzer with Larson, and then the top four are going to be Gudbranson, Fowler, Lindholm, Manson. So
it is interesting how Brendan Gulley is just totally out of the picture right now.
I think it's just them not being very happy with where he was at, which, granted, he's 21, 22 years old.
Oh, yeah, I know.
They're giving him time in the AHL to find his game.
I'm not writing him off. No, I'm just saying it's interesting.
I know. I'm just adding a bit of explanation for people out there, though, that with defensemen, you typically see them take a little bit longer to develop. But granted, that whole idea and thought process has started to go to the wayside as more and more younger guys have been breaking into the league, and it's become a younger league. So I think that it used to be that the exception to the rule was guys coming in at a young age, whereas I think it's now become more of the exception to the rule to have guys go back down to the minors at 22 or 23.
Well, speaking of that, nice little segue there. So after Monday's game against the St. Louis Blues, we would see some lineup changes. So Max Comtois sent down to the AHL, which I think was probably a long time coming.
Yeah, I think so. His numbers are not great this year.
They're not. And Isaac Lindstrom also sent down. Yeah, and so Max Comtois, I should note, did score against St. Louis on Monday. Also had a turnover that led to an opposing goal. And so I think overall his game has been really hit or miss. And I think we underrate a little bit the fact that he essentially got to the NHL straight from junior. If you look at his career arc so far, he's had a good junior career, really good junior career, and then he got a cup of coffee in the NHL last year, and then went back to junior, then got a little taste of the AHL, and that's it. So this idea that he was going to come in this season and be a contributor at the NHL level, it was an optimistic idea. Let's just put it that way, because I think the more realistic thing at this point is that he should probably, along with Isaac Lindstrom, who also looks just at times totally out of place defensively, should probably be spending the rest of the season in the AHL. I think both of those two should spend the rest of the season. Maybe Comtois gets another sniff at it just for the kind of confidence, whatever you want to call it. But where do you have those two right now? What's your evaluation of those two? Because I feel like, you know, in the kind of flow chart of their development, the highs and the lows, we're at a bit of a low point here, I would say.
Yeah, and so I'm actually going to throw up on the screen one thing that's
Which is fine, by the way. That's the nature of these things.
Yes, and so I'm going to throw up on the screen. Now, granted, there's a lot of information coming up on your screen, but I highly suggest going and checking out this website, waveintel.org. It's a new tool that's kind of come out. That's just kind of a really fun visualization tool. Sorry, that word tripped me up a little bit right there. But Max Comtois and Isaac Lindstrom are both on the screen. And you can see kind of from this that neither of them have really done anything that great. Both of them from a shot attempts perspective are below league average. They both allow a decent amount of shot attempts on goal when they're on the ice. They're both at, I think, Comtois at 42%, Corsi 4 percentage, 45.5% for Lundestrom. Both are below 45% expected goals, 4 percentage. So these aren't really great numbers for these guys. And I think the thing with Comtois that is the issue is we've seen him with multiple different centers, multiple different line mates, and it's kind of always yielded the same results. And he's a guy where you would hope if he was with maybe a certain type of line mate, he'd be able to really prosper. And we just haven't seen that from him. And to me, that's the big concern. Having said all that, they're both young.
They're both young and inexperienced, yes. I would say.
And so I think that because of where they're at in terms of age, Comtois is 20, Lundestrom's 19. There's still a whole lot more development that they can have in their game and come in their game from the going down to the AHL. So we saw it last year with Troy Terry going down, for instance, Max Jones going down. These guys really developed a lot. I think that the Ducks should really look at just sending them down and letting them really kind of find their game, work on a lot of things down there without the pressure of being in the NHL. I mean, at this point in time, what good is it going to do them this year to be in the NHL? How much is it going to, unless they go down to the AHL and blow the doors off, I'm not sure the benefit to really call them up.
Here's the concern with Max Comtois at this point in time. I want to stress that because things can change. It's that the center and actually the player that he's the skater, I should say, that he spent the most time with this season at 5-on-5 has been Ryan Getzlaff. So it's not like he's getting these crappy line mates. He's getting the Ducks' very best center. And in those minutes, if you look at the high danger chances, the Ducks have been outchanced 27-21. And from a shot attempt perspective, they've been outshot attempted 134-94. So I want to go out on a limb here and say that's probably not Ryan Getzlaff.
Yeah.
That's causing those numbers because Ryan Getzlaff hasn't always been a possession monster or a shot share monster, but he can keep up, right? He's not going to be a black hole, so to speak. And so that's a little concerning that you're giving him really the cushiest line mates and it's just not working out at all. But again, that's where he's at right now. There's still plenty of time for that to turn around. And for Isaac Lindstrom, Eric Stevens has talked about this, and I agree with it. In an ideal world, he probably never even plays in the NHL this season. But due to injuries, whatnot, that's just kind of the position they found themselves in. So that's that. Those two sent down. And so subsequently, the Lions going into Nashville on Thursday, Raquel Getzlaff-Sprong remaining together, who have been really good. Jones, Steele, Kasha, a line that I think has looked really good and looked good against Nashville particularly. They've had a lot of good moments. Chase DeLeo would get a cameo alongside Adam Henrique and Jakob Silverberg. Let's just say it was not a great cameo.
Yeah, not good.
And then, of course, the ever-reliable fourth line, Nick DeLaurier and Derek Grant with Carter Rowney. But
Derek
of course,
Grant, the big news from the forward perspective was Derek Grant coming back into the lineup and Jakob Silverberg coming back into the lineup in this game.
Yep. And Nick Ritchie seemingly on the cusp of coming back as well.
Yes. Probably going to come back post All-Star break, obviously. Now seems like he was close. So you would assume in a week or a little bit over a week, he'll be back and ready to go.
Yep. And obviously the big change that we already talked about, Lindholm next to Gudbranson, Fowler next to Manson, and then the monolith on the Ducks blue line, Larson and Holzer. Just never gonna give you up, Larson and Holzer, said Dallas Higgins. Okay, so jumping into the recap here, guess who would kick off the scoring for Anaheim in this one? None other than Josh Manson. Now, to be fair, this would come off of a really nice pass from Andre Kasha. Maybe one of the better assists we've seen from a Ducks player in quite some time. Gets the puck in the left faceoff circle, is almost at the boards, and is able to send a pass through the middle of the ice through about five different players, four different Nashville skaters. It finds Josh Manson on the weak side. He's able to receive it perfectly and roof it to give Anaheim the lead right as they would hit the 10-minute mark in the first period. So pretty nice play there by Andre Kasha.
Yeah, exactly. And it's one of those plays that kind of we had wanted to see Andre Kasha do. It's the type of play that we've all seen him do from time to time, but he, quite frankly, hasn't done it enough. So to be able to find Josh Manson on the back post there, and really good job by Manson to really jump down into kind of the low slot area and get it, make himself available for a pass, because a lot of times defensemen really try to stay up high on their point. And this was Manson, who's not always known for being an offensive type defenseman, seeing the space and taking advantage of it and jumping in to that space, and Kasha making a brilliant pass to find him. And Manson also makes a really good shot. He puts it in the top of the net. And so it's not an easy shot to make. And so there's a whole lot of good right there. Good on Josh Manson to get his first goal of the season also. He would like to see more goals from him at this point in time. It's not as if – here's the thing. It's not as if he's relied upon for his offense, but you still expect a guy that plays that much – to have more than a goal so far this season.
Yeah, and at that point, more than zero. Now, skipping ahead a little bit here, just about 2 minutes, the Ducks would double their lead on the power play, and this was an interesting play because there wasn't really a whole lot to it. The Ducks' power play just kind of looking a little static, but then Ryan Getzlaff plays it down to Andre Kasha, I believe, and then from there, Getzlaff gets it back. Sorry, that was down to Ricard Raquel. Getzlaff gets it back, and he's in the right face-off circle here. And instead of doing what he usually does, which to me is his worst tendency as a player by far, where he gets it and then just holds on to it infinitely, and gives the penalty killers all the time in the world to set up, he just catches it and fires it immediately. Now, I should note that Roman Josi did overcommit on this play for whatever reason, lunging down to cover Ricard Raquel below the goal line because, you know, he's going to score from back there.
Yeah.
And so Getzlaff recognizes this and makes the correct play. He one-times a pass all the way across the ice to Ricard Raquel, who's wide open in that left face-off circle. And Ricard Raquel does not get all of it. I'm starting to think he's just not that kind of shooter from the left face-off circle. But maybe regardless, UC Saros makes the save, and Adam Henrique picks up the rebound and is able to double Anaheim's lead, makes it 2-0. So another really nice assist here on this play from Ryan Getzlaff, his 20th assist of the season.
Shocker. Ryan Getzlaff's very, very good.
He just needs to not hang on to it infinitely. That's my only gripe.
Yeah, but that's something. Here's the thing with Getzlaff. He's not going to change his game at this point in time in his career.
I understand. And I'm aware.
Yeah, he's always done that. He's always going to do that at this point in time.
By the way, I did want to make a note because, you know, we're just a fully analytical, unbiased, everything has to be tangible type of podcast. But on this play, after the goal is scored, Matthias Ekholm looks over at Roman Josi and just kind of throws up his hands like, hey, what the hell? You know, body language. Body language is a thing.
Felix is now the body language analyzer there.
I'm the body language doctor, and did not look like a together group on that play.
Yeah,
but Roman Josi's not that good defensively. I don't think that's a shocker to anybody.
Roman Josi's a good player though in general.
Roman Josi's a great forward, very good forward.
That is a very bold take. That is a bold take, right?
I mean,
there.
He's gonna get 80 plus points this season.
I think he's solid defensively also.
No, he's fine. I'm kidding around. But
clearly.
I'm just kidding around. But it's not his it's not the strength of his game. The strength of his game is that he always has the puck. And when he has it, good things happen. So okay. Is that better for you? Is that okay?
Sure.
Is that a softer of a take?
Sure.
Couple minutes later, the Ducks would give up their first of the night, and this would be coming off a face-off loss. Not really sure why Ryan Getzlaff looks to kind of slap this puck out of play. He just kind of gets down on one knee and tries to hit it out of the zone off the face-off. Puck goes back to the point, and the shot finds its way through, gets deflected by Victor Arvidsson, and that would make it a 2-1 hockey game. Now, skipping ahead into the second period here, Ricard Raquel rebound goal for him, and this would come on a nice rush up ice. Ryan Getzlaff doing what he does best in open ice, kind of forcing defenders to lean a certain way, using his body to kind of direct traffic, looking guys off, and he brings it into the zone and then pivots around, drops it off to Cam Fowler. Puck just kind of finds its way to the net, and then Ricard Raquel jumps on the rebound and makes it a 3-1 game. So, hey, Ryan Getzlaff, not looking too shabby there either.
Exactly, exactly. And it's a really nice zone entry by him. One of the biggest things on this play was basically just his ability to... I know you had said he shouldn't hold on to the puck as long, but the thing is, him holding on to the puck there, really, it draws three defenders to him.
Oh, yeah. So, just to clarify, that comment was about the power play.
Fair.
So, I think that's a bad habit of his on the power play.
Fair.
Better?
But, yes. And then he feeds the puck after kind of drawing everyone to him, feeds it to Fowler, right? And Fowler gets the shot on net, Getzlaff gets a rebound, eventually ends up on Raquel's stick, who finishes it.
Yeah.
So, absolutely. Really, really nice play overall. A lot of good things that happen on that play, but the one thing that really stood out was the ability of Getzlaff to draft, essentially bring three different Nashville players to him and open up the ice for his line mates, because that's the biggest thing. If you can draw guys to you and open up space for other guys, because I mean, if you think about it, you have two or three guys on you, that means there's a lot of open space for your line mates. And if you have a guy with the passing ability of Ryan Getzlaff, you can find guys in that open space and they can finish. So also of note is that in this game, I think it was the first time Raquel was back with Getzlaff for a while, and they instantly saw results with these types of plays. I mean, those were two that played together a bunch over the past couple of years and had success doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and you put Daniel Sprong up there and just magic. Magic will happen. Now, we talked about the Ducks not having won back-to-back games in a long time. And, you know, I realized what was missing throughout all these months. Derek Grant, shorthanded goal. Breakaway at that in the third period. Just jumps on a turnover at Anaheim's blue line as they're in the dying seconds of their penalty kill, walks in all alone on UC Saros, goes with the signature Derek Grant move. You know, we talk about in sports that the Michael Jordan logo, that signature dunk move. Well, hey, you can make a logo for Derek Grant on the power play, fakes the shot, goes to the backhand and just slips it perfectly between the pads of the five hole of Saros to give Anaheim a 4-1 lead. So I know you're not the biggest Derek Grant guy, but what do you have to say now? Just comes back into the lineup. The team instantly starts winning again, and he scores.
I think I heard the broadcast tonight mention about Derek Grant that he has, I think it's like 8 goals in his last 16 games or something like that, and no assists in that time frame.
Why would you pass when you can score every time, every other game?
You want to guess what his shooting percentage is for this season?
Like 30?
18.2%. You want to guess what his career average is?
Like 6?
8.9%.
Okay. Okay. Well, I mean, hey, your shooting percentage is probably going to be higher if all you get is breakaways.
I mean, that is completely fair. If he keeps... Here's the thing. Yeah.
You're on a breakaway.
If he keeps getting breakaways, then sure, maybe this is sustainable. But I think at this point in time, it's awesome that he's doing this. I'm going to still say what I've said. He's not as good as he probably gets hyped up to be by everyone. His on-ice metrics are not amazing. Actually, though, in this game, they weren't horrible. That line actually played pretty well on the whole. From Natural Stat Trick, that line, let me just get it real quick. The Delorier Grant Rowney line was 50% Corsi 4 percentage, and 51% expected goals 4 percentage. So overall, not a pretty good night actually for that line on the whole, but I don't see Derek Grant being this great talent that is propelling the Ducks to these wins. So
I don't know. Correlation equals causation.
Yeah. So by
the way, Derek Grant this season, 37% on ice expected goals for percentage.
That's not good. That's not good.
That's insanely bad.
That's really bad. And that kind of that tells you all you need to know about the fact that.
He gets all the tough zone starts. What are you supposed to do?
This line's getting hyped up for being safe in their own zone, all this different type of stuff. They're just so reliable. But the thing is, whenever they're on the ice, they're getting more chances against than for. And that is not a good thing. And especially when their quality coming against. So we've talked about this a bunch. Good for Derek Grant to score again here. Honestly, I hope he keeps scoring because that boosts up his trade value.
Oh, my God. Heartless. Yep. Heartless Jake, back at it again.
10 goals in 35 games.
Second rounder, easy. Yeah. Okay, we're going to go into our first break here, and then on the other side of that, we're going to wrap up this Nashville game and then get into the Carolina game, so we'll be right back.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Okay, back from our first break here. So let's wrap up this Nashville recap. After Derek Grant makes it a 4-1 lead, the Predators would find a way to make it somewhat interesting in the final minutes. So the Ducks get a power play. And I found it hilarious that John Ahlers, the Ducks commentator, was saying, oh, yeah, you know, the Ducks are just going to hang on to it here. They don't need to score. They just got to hang on. There's 4 minutes left. And then instantly the Ducks turn it over, and it turns into a 3-on-1 the other way, shorthanded, for Nashville. Now, the Ducks did well to get back and at least somewhat break that opportunity up, but Mikael Granlund still had enough time to get free, and he would walk in on John Gibson and would roof it short side high. It was a perfect shot.
Yeah.
Probably a shot that John Gibson should stop.
No.
Yeah.
That's a perfect shot. You just said it.
Well, no, it was a perfect shot, but John Gibson was also down and had vacated that spot of the net before the shot was even released.
I don't know. That's a pinpoint accurate shot. I don't know if there's a whole lot more you can do on that. I think that is one where you look at it and just you tip your cap to the shooter.
Well, sure, but here's the reality, though. And, I mean, oh, man, he shoots it from almost at the goal line. It's a nice shot. But the point being, the new reality in the NHL is that guys can hit that shot. It's not like it was even 5 years ago. Guys, because goalies have gotten so good at sealing off that post, guys practice that shot now. That is a shot that most players, most skilled forwards have in their arsenal. And so, again, I'm not saying that that's reason to chastise John Gibson here, but the selection to go down on one pad and just kind of try to cover that post, it exposed the high side, and that's what guys are shooting for now. You know, it's interesting how there's been this kind of push and pull where goalies got so good at covering the bottom of the ice with the butterfly style, and now they leave open the top, and guys are just so good at roofing it that we're seeing that little tug of war. Hey, just make the nets bigger. How about that?
Sure. I'm actually very anti making the nets bigger.
Well, what do you do when the goalies have become gigantic and the puck is still the same size?
You don't make the nets bigger.
Well, here's what I will say, though. You know, because there's always the argument of, hey, the goalies are so much bigger now, pads are bigger, what are shooters supposed to do? Compare the sticks that shooters have now to the sticks in the 80s.
Yes.
And it's not like woe is me for the shooters.
Yes, exactly.
They've got some advantages as well.
Yeah.
One of my favorite what-ifs is, what if Ovechkin had to have his career with a wooden stick? I'm very curious how many goals he would have scored. I'm not saying it's all due to the composite stick, but if you look at how much flex he gets in that one timer, I don't think it's possible to shoot a puck that hard with a wooden stick.
What flex does Ovechkin use, though?
I think he's in the 90s.
Is he? I thought he was in the low. Isn't in like 80s?
I think he's
70s.
No, he's in 87 at the lowest, I believe.
I thought he was low, and that's how a stick gets so whippy.
No, he's just a beast of a man.
I mean,
he's just gigantic.
Also true.
He's like 240 pounds. Yeah. Like, those are the kind of guys who should be using that flex, not your average beer leaguer.
Yeah.
No subtweet there at all.
Wow. Jake. Wow. Thanks.
Yes. Yeah, so I don't know how. Well, that's my fault. We got into that tangent. That's okay, though. It's okay. Tangents are okay.
Tangents are fun.
So yeah, Ducks win this game 4-2, and it's a feel good win against.
Yep.
a competitive Nashville team.
Yes, and I think it's a really good performance from the Ducks team, especially after the egg that they laid in St. Louis, and also the poor performance in Chicago. And really, they just had poor performances for a while, and so it was good getting Silverberg back into the lineup. I think that even though that line was not good, DeLeo, Henrique, and Silverberg were not good on the whole, but I think it just kind of solidified different portions of the lineup and really kind of helped put things into place. And I think that you saw that on the whole. And then, I mean, the other big talking point is the D pairs and how good Cam Fowler has been this year. I mean, we can get into that a little bit after we get through tonight's game, but
no, that's okay. Because I think yesterday was the shining example.
Yes,
of it.
But Fowler Manson were dominant yesterday, and that's a pairing that we saw a fair amount last year, and they never put up that good of numbers. They didn't have a game like this ever, and it almost feels like Dallas Eakins has really kind of found something in Fowler's game and helped him to kind of push that to the next level. Because you look at Cam Fowler, and every single player that he's played with this year has been better with him than without him. And
it's something that we've never seen with him in his career. And this is a first at age 28.
We've constantly talked about Cam Fowler as being a partner dependent type player, where he was so reliant upon having someone with him who could be, that could kind of help him out and help make him look good, basically. And if he was not with a partner that was great, you would really kind of notice it in his numbers. But what you see, and this is kind of the big thing, and is what you see from top defensemen in this league is no matter who they play with, they elevate that player's game. And we saw that over the last little bit. We've seen that all season from Cam Fowler. The fact that he took Eric Goodbranson, who was kind of had this scarlet letter in a way on him, where he was just kind of looked down upon. I mean, granted, we were as guilty. And after playing with Cam Fowler, his numbers have been so much better. And he's looked like a actually competent NHL defenseman as compared to what the reputation of him was. And you also see that with Michael Delzato. You see it with Brendan Gulley. If you look at Brendan Gulley's numbers with and without Fowler, it's drastic between the two.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's the thing that's interesting is that whoever plays with Fowler just sees this huge uptick in their shot metrics. And I think to me, part of that is because Fowler is so involved in the play and he's constantly getting shots from the point or joining the rush that not only does that elevate your numbers, but that also reduces the amount of volume you're facing against because he's just always driving play. He's always moving that puck. And so that's really good for Josh Manson. I mean, like you said, I tweeted this yesterday, but Eric Goodbranson gets put with Cam Fowler, has his best season ever. Josh Manson gets put with Cam Fowler, has his best game of the season. I mean, it's crazy how, to a man, everyone is better with him. So that's a very positive development for Anaheim. Obviously, I'm starting to question how great of a measuring stick the Nashville Predators are. But regardless, it's a positive sign because it's just not something that anyone expected based on what we've seen in the past.
Agreed.
Now, this is getting back to the tangent here really quickly, but Ovechkin uses an 80 flex. So you were actually right.
Ha, ha.
You were right. I don't know why I thought he used a higher flex, but yeah, that's pretty ridiculous for a guy who's 235 pounds. But then again, when you get free sticks, it's a little different.
Yeah, exactly. You can test out a lot of different things.
Yeah. Okay. Now, do you want to get into the Carolina game, or did you have anything else to mention about the Nashville game?
No, I don't really have anything else to really mention. DeLeo was not very good.
I don't think he's an NHL player.
Yeah.
He looked incredibly slow.
Yeah.
And, that's what else is there to say, really. Okay, let's jump into the Carolina game. So, this was a much different game, and it makes sense because much different opponent. The Hurricanes are, although they are somewhat battling for a playoff spot, they are still one of the, if not one of the best teams in the NHL. You know, they play a really high octane game, really strong shot metric team. They just do everything well. They have talent up and down the lineup, except maybe in net. That's the only question mark for them. But they're a very good team. And Anaheim managed to get a very good performance. Well, would you call it very good? I would just maybe call it solid. They managed to play a solid game.
I think this was a very good performance from a 5-on-5 perspective.
Yeah.
I think the fact that this is against, I think looking at the team that they're playing against is very key in this conversation. And the fact that the Hurricanes are one of the top teams in the league at driving play and generating offense, the fact that the Ducks were able to really kind of hold their own against them at 5-on-5 was very critical. And I think the most interesting thing from this game is that you look at the first period, and we'll get into it a bit more on the recap, but it looked almost like the Ducks were about to get run off the ice. The Hurricanes,
yes, especially in that first period, like you said.
The Hurricanes were really generating shots, generating chances. And then after the first period, the Ducks really kind of were able to kind of stop the bleeding a little bit and really kind of just start generating their own chances. And that second period was critical, and it really kind of led that way in the third period, where the Ducks didn't look like the team that were on the back end of back-to-backs, and they were really pushing the pace as compared to the Hurricanes, who is the team that's known for doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And there were definitely moments where you thought to yourself, like, uh-oh, you know, these Hurricanes look really good. But the Ducks did manage to hang in there with them. Should also note the Hurricanes also played yesterday. They played against the Blue Jackets.
That is true.
But I mean, to me, that doesn't really change anything, because it's all things are equal at that point. So it's not as if any team has an advantage in that sense. Now, Sebastian Aho would open the scoring in this game. 4 minutes into the first period, gets the first goal, goes to the net off of a face-off loss in the Anaheim zone, and tips home a wrist shot. Pretty similar goal to the one we saw that Arvidsson scored against Nashville on Thursday. Just Ducks losing a face-off in their own zone, and it immediately turning into a redirect goal. So I don't know if there's really anything to be drawn there from, but regardless, it's obviously not ideal. Ducks would find a way to climb back in it at the end of the first period, though, after being outshot 15-8. Erik Gudbranson picks up a really nice feed from Ryan Getzlaff, but more importantly, Erik Gudbranson recognizes that the Hurricanes are totally overcommitted to one side of the ice, sneaks into that open area, and walks in all alone. I mean, has a red carpet on his way to James Reimer, and puts on a little move, sneaks it between the pads of James Reimer, and he picks up a goal, and that would tie this game up. So Erik Gudbranson just keeping it rolling. I mean, it is pretty amazing how good he has been for Anaheim this season.
It really is, and the fact that he's now doing this again, and now granted, the last two games have kind of been opposite ends of the spectrum for him in terms of how that pairing with Lindholm is done, but
yeah, new partner, you know.
Yes, so,
I think going from playing with Fowler to almost anyone else is a pretty big adjustment, I would say.
Agreed with that. But the big thing on this play, it's the same exact thing that we said about Josh Manson in the Nashville game, but good on Gudbranson to kind of identify that there's time or that there's space for him and take it. And Getzlaff, the pass from Getzlaff is just insane.
Yeah, that's two games in a row now with some sweet assists.
Yes, and I tweeted this out during the game, but we don't really talk about Getzlaff enough, I think. And that's not saying that we don't talk about him.
Bold take.
We do, but I feel like we just don't talk about how good his vision and passing still is.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't go away. That's the thing.
No, but
it's everything else that fades away.
Agreed. But I feel like the thought of Getzlaff still being this elite playmaker is kind of gone. And I think, I wouldn't say he's elite, but he's still so skilled and can make ridiculous passes. And I just think he doesn't get enough talk about that from a national perspective and even from a local perspective. And I think it's just something that we're watching one of the greater passers in league history. And it's just a joy to watch at this point in time.
And I think what's impressive about Ryan Getzlaff is that he's one of the maybe the best just standstill passer that I've watched, because he does that a lot. Even when it's not on the power play, there are definitely instances where he's just stationary along the perimeter and he just finds a way to create a lane by looking guys off and getting it through. And if you look at some of the other great playmakers in history, I mean, I'm not equating them, but like Wayne Gretzky, a lot of his assists were him creating the space by skating in, dragging the defense to one side, and then dropping it off to another side. Crosby does that as well. Crosby's assists are a lot of just that crazy work ethic down low and then setting someone up. Getzlaff is just like almost like a quarterback in his pocket.
Yeah.
Just looking for his receivers downfield and diming them up. It's pretty impressive to watch, and it's really unique. You just don't see that in today's game. And I've talked about this maybe a little bit, but that's kind of one of the unfortunate things that we're seeing. Although I think the NHL is in maybe the best place it's ever been from a skill perspective. The guys coming in now are so good. There's also a lot of cookie cutter players where everyone has a skills coach starting at age 10, maybe even younger. Everyone's doing the same drills. Everyone's kind of practicing the same stuff. And so by the time guys get to the pros, they're way more skilled than they've ever been, but they're all kind of skilled in similar ways. You don't see that kind of unique play style from different guys anymore. You don't see a guy coming in who plays like a Ryan Getzlaff, for example. So, you know, I mean, I'm totally nitpicking here, but that's one little byproduct that we've seen kind of rise up here. Back into this recap, though. So, end of the second period, Daniel Sprong. Hey, we haven't talked about him much in this podcast, but comes in on a rush and puts on a perfect kind of toe drag move, gets his defenseman sliding, and then opens up a better shooting opportunity in the slot, gets a shot off, and gets denied by James Reimer. But quite the play. Hey, you know, Daniel Sprong a little quieter lately, but he's still pretty effective out there, I would say. What do you think of his game lately?
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't his banner game. I think he did not shoot it as much as he has in the past, but he still had 3 shot attempts, 2 scoring chances.
He gets his numbers.
Yes, he will consistently get shots, and he had 1 shot on goal tonight. So a little bit low for him in that perspective at 5-on-5, but
yeah,
I mean, you always know that Daniel Sprong is going to get a puck on net during a game. I feel like it's shocking if Daniel Sprong does not have a shot on goal.
Yeah, and he doesn't do it just throwing it from the perimeter either. Like, he's creating chances for himself, and had, I think, 1 turnover at the end of the third period that may have cost him his candidacy in overtime. Who was it under Randy Carlyle that would never play in overtime? Was it Ryan?
It was
Corey Perry. Yep. Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
This was one of our, I think, original, not bits, but one of your original frustrations that was consistently voiced in this podcast.
Yes, it was.
Was Corey Perry never playing?
Yes.
In 3-on-3 overtime.
Made no sense. Still say it makes no sense.
And Daniel Sprong is proudly taking on that mantle. He's just never going to play at 3-on-3. It's fine. I, you know, with Daniel Sprong, you just got to be happy that he's in the NHL at all at this point. I think you just got to look at it that way. Now, moving along here, so the Ducks would get would draw a penalty at the end of the second period and then would get a power play to start the third. And you would think, hey, fresh sheet of ice, this is a great opportunity. And maybe one of their worst power plays of the season. I mean, the Hurricanes play such a frenetic pace when they're killing penalties because they just pressure the puck carrier so hard. And the Ducks' power play being so static as it is, they did not take well to that, and the Ducks really struggled on that one.
Nope.
Now, Josh Manson would make a really nice diving play to break up a Carolina rush later in the third period. So the numbers for him and Fowler were not nearly as good tonight. But I thought, hey, with Josh Manson, you're kind of dialing down the expectations right now. And as long as he's having those moments, you're thinking, okay, that's a step forward, especially on a brand new pairing against a really good team. Later in the game, Sam Steele come down to 3-on-1, tries to put on the toe drag for a shot. Probably it's a situation you want to see him pass, but a bit of judging it by the result. Now, speaking of Sam Steele, going into overtime here. So, not really much of a, I guess, consistent pace to this overtime. At points, the Ducks almost turned it over behind their own net. Hampus Lindholm had some trouble. Andre Kasha almost coughed it up. And somehow the Ducks are able to turn that into an eventual breakaway for Sam Steele. So the Hurricanes bringing it into the Anaheim zone, they turn it over, and then a stretch pass finds Sam Steele in the quick turnaround. He comes down on the breakaway, and it's funny because I actually thought that he might get broken up there by Jake Gardner, because Jake Gardner was within about a stick length, and you're thinking, okay, NHL defenseman can probably make up that ground, but Sam Steele showed some nice little burst there, because not only does he accelerate initially, but he keeps his body between the defenseman and the puck in a position where if Gardner's to take it from him, he has to hook him or just take a penalty. So nice puck protection there from Sam Steele. And then just comes in, doesn't really send a lot of information, to James Reimer, so you can't really tell whether he's going to shoot Pat or Deke, whatever, and instead just kind of fires it on net, goes high blocker side, beats Reimer, and that wins the game for Anaheim. So a feel-good win going into this break here.
Yeah, it definitely is. And the fact that it's wins on back-to-back nights, the fact that they played two good games, and I think that's the most critical part. And yes, you got to get the win. I think from a mentality perspective, just picking up the win really does help from that perspective. But
you can't just lose every game.
No. But I think for me, the bigger piece of these last two games is they didn't win by smoke and mirrors. They outplayed the other team, or at least were on par with the other team. And I think against Nashville, you can say they outplayed Nashville. I think against Carolina, they potentially outplayed them. And I think
they were in it in against Carolina.
And I think against Carolina, the biggest thing was that they really went after it. And if you look at, as I'm going to pull up onto the screen, if you look at things like the expected goal totals at 5-on-5, you see that in the third period, it really started getting swung in the Ducks' favor. And I think that's the most interesting part of this, is that this is a tie game, and the Ducks were the one kind of pushing for the win. And I think that's the critical part of this game for the Ducks.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to jump into our second break here, and then on the other side of that, we're probably going to get into some listener questions and some final thoughts. So we'll be right back. Okay, back from the final timeout. So with that win, as Momorg points out in our Twitch chat, Ducks are no longer last in the Western Conference. They are 2 whole points ahead of the LA Kings with a game in hand. Now, maybe if you're a fan of the tank, that's not what you want to see. But regardless, you know, something to hang your hat on.
Yep, sure. Yeah.
Jake, just no reaction.
Yep.
Just too busy looking up numbers or whatever he's doing.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm keeping you guessing. What was interesting, though, with this game is that after we saw Manson and Fowler really take off against Nashville, the roles were reversed tonight. So Lindholm and Gudbranson had a really solid game from an expected goals perspective, controlling 69.7% of the expected goals on ice. And you know, part of that number is probably propped up a little bit by Gudbranson's chance. You know,
Gudbranson shot the puck a lot tonight. He did. It is insane. He shot the puck 8 times tonight.
But even from a defensive standpoint, the expected goals against with Lindholm and Gudbranson on the ice was 0.58. And with Fowler and Manson, it was 1.04. So almost half of what Fowler and Manson give up. So Lindholm, Gudbranson, really solid. Fowler, Manson down at 39.8%. So the hope there is that there will be a game where both of those two are clicking. You don't have to dominate necessarily, but just both above 50%. We'll see if those roles ever get reversed. What did you kind of make of the new look pairings tonight overall?
I thought overall it was good. I think that obviously Gudbranson and Lindholm were the better pairing out of all of them. But I think on the whole it was good. Fowler Manson were at 40% expected goals, 4% per money puck. Lindholm, Gudbranson, 70%. So not exactly great from Fowler Manson, but I think also when you put in the context that Carolina is a team that that generally drive play, generally control play, even being around 40% is not horrible for that team. So or for that pairing. So Larson Holzer, horrible per usual. Nothing really to see here there.
If the Ducks were to make one move just to improve their team this season, just to not be absolutely terrible defensively down the stretch, maybe just go pick up a third pairing D off the scrap heap. I mean, they do have Michael Delzato, who for whatever reason doesn't play every game. I'm not the biggest Michael Delzato guy, but he's definitely better than Jacob Larson.
He's also definitely better than Corbinian Holzer.
He's also definitely not a 22-year-old Jacob Larson prospect type player who the organization probably wants to get him missed. Because if this was about merit, Michael Delzato would be playing every game over one of those guys.
Yes.
So that's just the way it goes, though. That's the way this season is.
He should be playing over Holzer. It's not as if Holzer's that either.
But then the two lefties situation, and you're forgetting the bromance between Corbinian Holzer and Dallas Eakins.
True.
They've got a bromance going. One other thing I did want to mention that we can trace back to the Nashville game, Adam Henrique is back at center. no more of the Adam Henrique at wing situation. And I'm not saying that the Ducks' improved performances are because of that, but maybe having two solid NHL centers in Getzlaf and Henrique, as opposed to Getzlaf, Kids, and then the fourth line, I think that kind of matters.
Yeah.
Just a touch.
Yeah. And I think that the reason why they moved him to wing was with the lineup and everything, maybe the justification there was to load up that top line to really try to get goals.
Yeah, but they gave up so much in doing that,
yes,
though, which agreed. Is fine. Well, I mean, look, this is a season that's not about squeezing the most out of each and every game.
Yeah, well, it's also the cards that were dealt with the injuries and with who's there. I mean, who else?
But also, well, here's the thing. So sorry to cut you off there, yeah. But here's the thing. We can't have it both ways, right? We've talked about a lot on this podcast how, hey, if you're going to call the Kids up, you got to give them real opportunities. Isaac Lindstrom being a second line center is a real opportunity. Yeah. If you put him at the wing, you know, that's not where he's projected to be as an NHL player. At least by most scouts, you know, people see him as a center moving forward. Although I think he played wing in Sweden, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, all of this to say, you can't have it both ways. If you want to give the kid the opportunity, you got to live with the result. And so that's what the Ducks are doing. And in a way, I do give them credit for that, because it would have been really, I mean, it's obvious to anyone watching this team that the Kids haven't been up to snuff for most of the season. And it would be really easy to marginalize them in the lineup, have them spend the entire season in San Diego. And instead, they've given a guy like Isaac Lindstrom, who's probably way ahead of schedule here, they've given them a real opportunity. So it is what it is. You're sacrificing results in the present for what hopes to be, you know, an investment for the future. But yeah, Henrique at center is a big upgrade over Lindstrom right now. Significant upgrade.
Yep.
And once they get Nick Ritchie back, they've got a solid top six all of a sudden.
Yep, and we'll actually talk about Ritchie, though, because we've got some questions about it. But
let's do it.
So, for those of you watching this on YouTube, yes, you can find the show on YouTube by searching for the AC Pod. If you want to like the show there, leave comments there. We will read through them, and it really just helps if you want to subscribe to the channel. If you hit that bell, you will get notified anytime there is a new video posted up there. We also obviously have the recorded version of the show, but the real fun part of the show is the Twitch stream. You can find us at twitch.tv/acpod, where you can watch us do us live. If you want to subscribe to the channel, it really does help out significantly. With Amazon Prime, you get one free Twitch Prime subscription each and every month, and it does help out more than you can imagine. You get special emotes in the chat, special badge next to your name, and even if you don't want to subscribe, if you follow the channel, you'll get notified whenever the channel does go live. And so on top of my tweet saying that we're live, you'll also get notified when the channel has gone live, so you can tune in live and be notified.
Hey,
about
if you subscribe, we'll put a buzzer underneath your shirt, so every time we go live,
wow,
we'll just buzz you.
Yeah. We'll be watching and let you know when.
Little baseball reference there for those who've been all following the Astros fiasco.
So here we go. Tony asked this question early on and then re-asked it because it's one that I want to talk about because I think it's interesting because Tony is someone who does not exactly think Nick Ritchie is that great and has brought up in the past when we've had conversations about it on our Discord and different things like that, that essentially Ritchie has gotten prime opportunities and has not been able to cash in, and even brought up in our Twitch chat tonight the fact that Comtois has more goals and more points than Ritchie does this season. And kind of so this question falls in line with that is, when do you have to stop looking at expected goals? And I think I'll add to this underlying metrics and understand that a player might just not be able to score.
So the question there is,
when do you have to, as in, at what point do we stop citing that Nick Ritchie is good because of these advanced metrics and say, well, actually, he hasn't put up the number, so he's not actually good?
So this is an interesting point of clarification. The numbers and what we're seeing on the ice are not two separate things. The numbers are just what happened, and we're just putting them in categories. So what Nick Ritchie does well results in these good kind of underlying shot metric type statistics, but what Nick Ritchie does well also doesn't really add up to goals and assists. He's not an individually talented scorer, playmaker type. He's just a guy who, when he's out there, he's going to do the little things, win board battles, make that little kind of 4-foot pass in the neutral zone to spring an oncoming forward. He's going to do those little things, win battles down low in the offensive zone, screen the goalie. He's got a decent shot. I think that that was probably a bit overrated when he was a prospect. But he just does all those little things that kind of make a line work. And you see that show up in the underlying numbers. And then as far as his counting stats, I don't know if he'll get there. Maybe with added power play opportunity, whatever. So I don't think it's an either or proposition. It is what it is.
I think that I do want to add this to it because I think that if you were to look at his numbers so far this season from a rates perspective, his underlying numbers in terms of his shots are pretty solid from the whole. His individual expected goals per 60, I think this is more so where Tony is coming from. His individual expected goals per 60 is the top in the top on the Ducks at essentially one goal per 60 minutes. And his individual shot attempt is at, let me see. He is fifth on the league in that. He is first on the team in high danger Corsi, high danger chance four. So I think from this perspective, maybe his numbers will never be as good as his individual expected goals are saying. He might not be a guy that can outperform that, but to the idea of he's just in these primo spots, he's in these good spots with other players, and Tony's even saying that if you put him in front of a goal, put Tony in front of the goalie, he'll get some pucks may bounce on him, off him. And
I've seen Tony play. I believe that.
We have.
I think he can get that done.
But I think to that knowledge is that, or to that point is that, he's in these spots. He's getting to these good spots and putting himself into a position to score and getting dangerous chances. And yes, at a certain point, you do have to take a look and say, well, hey, he hasn't put them in. That might not be the best. But the thing is, other players like Max Comtois, for instance, this is where this comes into play.
They don't do that.
Have not gotten, they've been put in those similar situations and in better, Comtois with Getzlaf, but has not been able to put up those same shots, has not been able to get to that position. And getting in those positions is definitely important. And I think to the point of at what point do you not look at expected goals and look at just raw production, I think you need a bigger sample size than 27 games. 27 games is not that much, and that's how many Nick Ritchie has played this season. Realistically, for a player to have his numbers kind of come to where they should be, it's gonna take a season or two. If Ritchie over the course of three seasons continues to put up these types of stats, it would not be shocking to me if he has multiple 20 goal seasons.
Multiple.
If he over four seasons puts up these same individual expected goal stats. Now remember, these are better than Rickard Rakell. These are better than a lot of players on the Ducks. If he continually puts these up, he will have some seasons where he outproduces what he should be just simply because he's getting dangerous shots. And it would not shock me if he got over 20 goals multiple seasons.
Yes, I agree with that. I mean, maybe not multiple, but he could get to that point.
I think multiple means two or more.
Two or more. Okay.
I think that's fair.
Okay. Well, look, I mean, here's the thing with Nick Ritchie, because you brought up the Max Comtois comparison. And with Nick Ritchie, it's taken him a while to get to this point. If you look at his career arc, the first season where he played only in 33 games, and his impact on expected goals was negative. He was at negative 0.66, so relative to his team. And since that time, we've seen a steady climb. So his first full season with the Ducks in 16-17, he was at plus 2.75. And then in 17-18, he went up to plus 3.9. Last year, a bit of a dip at plus 0.27. But now this year, he's up to plus 7.86. So this year might be a bit of an outlier in how good his underlying numbers have been. But you could almost make the argument he's just consistently been a guy who has a good impact on 5-on-5 play. I don't know. But you can see that there's been a progression. And so when you're talking about a guy like Comtois, who often gets compared to Nick Ritchie, this is the season that's kind of the write-off from this perspective. Next season, you're hoping to see some improvement.
Yep. One thing on Comtois I want to say is that if you're trying to compare the two, Comtois is a guy that if you look at his individual expected goals in all situations, he's should be at about 4.6 goals, and he's at 5 so far this year. So he's performing from a goals perspective right around where he should be. In terms of Nick Ritchie, if he was just an average shooter so far this year,
mm-hmm.
league average, he'd have seven mm-hmm. goals.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, he might not be. Who knows? All right. We should probably get into another question.
Yeah. So let's get into this other question that we got from Tony at the top. He said, if one of our biggest reasons for wanting Dallas Eakins as the coach is that he's very good at developing young talent, why do we keep wanting to send the young talent down? We don't expect to win this season. Might as well get some development done.
Yeah, I mean, we just kind of talked about this, the push and pull of what your goals are. And so for the Ducks, I mean, this season is about development. You know, really, it's about turning a new leaf over into this kind of new wave of Ducks, and also finding out who will and will not be part of that next wave. I think that that's also another thing. And so, sure, I think that when we talk about sending guys down, it's when the players hit ruts and you don't want them to stay in that rut, and maybe just going down and playing in a lesser pressure environment, maybe that just kind of gets them kickstarted. We talk so much about how that we saw that with Troy Terry last year, and to an extent, Sam Steele. Sam Steele also had a really good season in the AHL. So there are guys like Comtois and Lundestrom who I think just got in that rut and were not showing progress. And at a certain point, maybe it's just best that you send them down. Maybe they're just not ready. That happens. That's okay. Not everyone gets into the NHL and is just going to start at, you know, at a certain skill level at game one, and by game 82, they're just that much better. They might be more experienced, but that doesn't mean they've picked up good habits. And so when you see that kind of stuff creeping into their game, I think it's fair to send them down and maybe send them down for the rest of the season. It's hard to develop at the NHL level because there's so much more pressure. Everything is on the line every game. Even if you're the worst team in the league, you're still playing for 2 points. You're still playing in the best league in the world. So when you go down to the AHL, I just think that takes a weight off of a prospect, and maybe they can actually be a bit more cerebral in what they need to work on. I don't know. I mean, this is all just totally spitballing, but I think there's some validity to it.
Yep. All right. So Lewis X209 asked question, who's more likely to be traded to the Ducks? Erik Karlsson, PK Subban, or Roman Josi? The Ducks said they're willing to take on a bad contract. So I'm going to rule out Roman.
Is Roman Josi a bad contract?
No. I mean, it's a long contract, so I think that's why he threw it in.
But he's been really good.
Yeah,
so.
And Erik Karlsson, the term on that, there's the thing with a bad contract, what you have to remember is the term cannot be so extensive where it's...
So really, this is PK Subban. Yeah,
which would make sense.
PK Subban has 2 years left after this year at $9 million a year. And is going to take up a lot of cap space, even for a rebuilding team. That's a pretty significant chunk. The thing is, what would New Jersey, a team, we talked about this on the last Patreon episode, by the way, what would a team like New Jersey, who they themselves are in a rebuild, are they really going to be wanting to give up futures just to get off that contract?
No.
For them, they might as well just eat it and see if they can get out of it somehow. But hey, you know, we've talked about this, or, you know, many have talked about this, that you don't also want a rebuild to just be this totally depressing affair either. You need some veterans around to just kind of keep, you know, the ship on a certain path. And I think with a guy like Subban, he gave a really good interview the other day that they aired on 31 Thoughts, the podcast, where he talked about, hey, you know, we are where we're on the standings, but it's still a privilege. It's still a challenge to show up and play in every game. And there's still that attitude in the locker room. And so I think you still need a guy like that around, even when you're going through those rebuilds. And again, for the Devils, I don't think there's really any upside to giving up future just to get out of that. They're not that close to being contenders.
Yep. I completely agree with that. We got this question from the Frostpack. Who are some prospects / younger guys who have really disappointed this season, even taken steps back? I'm not letting you talk about Jakob Larsson.
Why don't you take this question? Because I feel like my existence is talking about this topic. So why don't you touch on this?
To avoid the easy answer of saying Jakob Larsson.
Has he disappointed, though?
Yes.
To disappoint would be to be below expectations.
Okay.
So
it depends on what your expectations were. And as Felix has long stated, he did not believe Jakob Larsson was an NHLer even. So I think maybe the one that disappointed me the most overall is a guy that honestly hasn't played that much for the Ducks this season, but Brendan Gulli.
Interesting choice.
I mean, it's not a bad one necessarily. I mean, Comtois, you expected to have highs and lows and go up and down. Same thing with Lundestrom. Same thing with all the kids. Maybe you could make the argument that Terry and Steele have both disappointed because we both had talked about the fact where if they were good, if they were in the 40-plus point range, the Ducks could be competitive, and it almost felt like the Ducks were banking on that with being competitive for this upcoming season. But I'm going to go with the Brendan Gulli one because he's a guy that I came in with a whole lot of hype for, the fact that him and Fowler worked so well together last season. The fact that he's barely played it, it's kind of a disappointment.
I agree with Brendan Gulli, and we kind of talked about it in the beginning of the show, how he's just fallen off the radar and how so many were, including ourselves, were pretty excited about what the, you know, what the Ducks had gotten out of that Brandon Montour trade. A guy in Brendan Gulli who, bit of a project, but who looked like he had some upside, and then a first round pick, which would turn into Braden Tracy. And I mean, you look at that trade now, do you feel any differently about it? From an Anaheim perspective?
I don't think so, because I think it's too early to really tell. And I mean, realistically,
I think the decision making was still sound.
I think 2-3 years down the line, maybe we could have this conversation again with what Brandon Montour is for the Buffalo Sabres and what Braden Tracy has become, what Brendan Gulli has become. But I don't think that's a deal that you can necessarily judge on a short term kind of look at.
Well, so allow me to judge it then. I will take on the mantle of judging it. Here's the thing. So you can judge it now, and with the caveat that, hey, it's still early. And looking at it from the it's still early perspective, Brandon Montour gets to play with Rasmus Dahlin in Buffalo. Now, Rasmus Dahlin is a top pick. He's, you know, been kind of hyped as a generational defensive talent. Still very young, though. And I mean, I don't know. It's hard to say. We don't really see too many young defensemen like that come in and dominate right away. Now, with Brandon Montour and Rasmus Dahlin on the ice this season, the Sabres are controlling 53% of the shot attempts, and they're not necessarily a strong 5-on-5 team. And then when you look at expected goals, it's interesting because they're down to 44.9%. So I don't really know what to make of it. It's a bit of a toss-up there, and Montour has 12 points in 34 games. So meanwhile, Brandon Gulli has just, again, kind of fallen off the radar. I think really both teams kind of traded problems with Montour and Gulli, and the Ducks got a first round pick out of it. So I think it's still looking decent for Anaheim, even though Brandon Montour is a bit more of a finished product. Brandon Montour is also 25. That's something that we maybe underrate a little bit here.
Yeah. Where is this?
Actually, Brandon Montour is going to be 26 in 3 months.
Yeah. Hardcore Luchador asks us, why is Fowler not an all-star?
Already six defensemen in the Pacific that were picked up? Is that the excuse?
There was only one defenseman that had been picked.
Out of all of the all-stars?
There was only one defenseman for the Pacific before before Quinn Hughes got in on the final vote. There's only two defensemen.
Well then, yeah, Fowler should probably be in there. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I don't have strong all-star opinions.
I don't either. So, I'm going to watch. It will be entertaining, but it is what it is.
I'll watch. By the way, Troy, so I didn't answer who was my most disappointing. Mine is Troy Terry, because he started off really well. His first five games, like much of this team, were really impressive. And he really, really kind of came back down to earth. And he has 3 goals on the year in 33 games. And he's not really snake bitten because his expected goals is 3.38. So he's not, it's not like he's just suffering from some poor luck. So the other disappointing thing with him is I just still don't think he really makes a tangible impact enough game to game. So he's another guy that I'm kind of keeping my eye on. We'll see. It's still early for him as well.
Yeah. So Bonnie had this question for us. She included this quote saying, this is from an Eric Stevens article on the kids, and said, if you went to look at their ice time in the first 10-20 games of the season, you look at their ice time now, it's drastically up for a few of them. That's the biggest thing. It's the amount of trust we have. We're not guys on our team. You may have noticed Basically, Dallas Aikens was saying he used to not trust them in the D zone and would only start them in the O zone, whereas now he's starting to give them more D zone starts. And so Bonnie's question for that is, have you seen evidence of Aikens' comments having an impact or more time for certain ducklings paying off?
No, not really. I think Dallas Aikens has to sell right now that the kids are better, because to me, that's really the only thing that he's being graded on this season. I mean, sure, maybe they've gotten a little better, you know, maybe a little sharper. You know, everyone's talking about, including Dallas Aikens, how much better Sam Steele is in the faceoff circle. Great.
Yeah.
You know, that's awesome.
Everyone listening to this probably knows how we feel about
faceoffs. You know how I feel about faceoffs. Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, the whole zone start thing, there's been articles written about how that's not really that impactful in terms of overall results. It does show that the coach trusts them more, which is good. And so clearly they're doing something to earn that trust. They couldn't just be out there getting slaughtered. But if you look at Lundestrom and Comtois' overall numbers, they're not very good. So I'm not totally sure what to make of it. This is probably a conversation for a different day, but I still don't really know what kind of coach Dallas Aikens is. I still don't have much of a read on how he coaches this team.
I think we're not going to really have a full read on it till halfway through next year.
Well, I don't think we're going to have a read on it until this is a competitive team and the games truly matter. And, you know, there's a subtext there of when that will happen.
Mm-hmm. So Lewis asked us, which stadium series uniform is worse, the Kings or the Avs?
Good question.
Oh, it's an easy question.
Well, I think the kind of politically correct answer is the Avs.
How is that? What do you mean politically correct?
Well, I think there was more negative reaction to the Avalanche's jerseys on Twitter than there was the Kings. I could be wrong about that.
I mean, I don't know. I didn't really see the backlash too much about it, but
I kind of like them both. Is that an unpopular opinion?
A little bit. The Kings one is bad. I love the Avs jersey, to be honest. I really like what they did. I do not like the Kings jersey. I don't like the chrome helmet either. I think it's awful. I think it looks...
Yeah, you're just way wrong
I'm
about
very,
that. That's sick.
Have you watched... You know what it reminds me of? Have you ever watched any highlights from like a European hockey game, a Swedish game, and isn't there like the leading goal scorer on the team, leading goal scorer in the league
awesome.
Has the gold helmet? The chrome helmet looks like that, and that helmet always looks awful.
Well, it's an Air Force theme because they're playing at the Air Force Academy Stadium in Colorado Springs.
I guess.
I think it's different. What, you know, like, you may not like it, that's fine, but to me, LA's jersey is sleek. It's trying something new in a sport that loves to... If you talk about a sport, you know, the NHL is very eco-friendly because they recycle everything. Coaches, jersey designs, all-star game formats, everything is just one big recycling loop. And so I like that they tried something different with the jerseys, with the helmets. The Avs jersey I'm not quite as big of a fan of, but I'm a fan of just trying something.
Oh,
is that so wrong?
I think the King Stadium series jersey isn't really trying anything. It feels boring to me. I'll get behind the chrome helmet being different. I agree that doing things different is a good thing, trying things out in these games.
Yeah, and the white gloves.
White gloves
look.
I'm good with, but...
They look like a roller hockey team.
That actually is probably...
They look like a Narch team
they
for
do.
Those who know roller
they
hockey.
Actually do look like a roller hockey team. That is probably my biggest complaint.
They're a SoCal team. Roller hockey is deeply embedded in SoCal. I think I'm sure that's not part of the thinking, but it's a nice little homage to the local roller hockey scene.
The Ducks need to get in another Stadium Series game to get better, to get some jerseys.
I was going to say the Ducks need to matter again, but then I realized the Kings are in this game.
Yeah,
so,
exactly. Exactly.
The Kings are probably a bigger draw, though, nationally.
Tony asked, would it be mean to go after Gerard Gallant? You knew that we were going to get this question at some point.
Tony's just hitting us hard tonight. Maybe it's because when we do less pods, the questions just come in more ruthless. I don't think Gerard Gallant's going to a rebuilding team. I think he's coming in as a guy who wants to win a Stanley Cup because he was in this Cup final 2 years ago. And I just don't see why he would want to get out of that loop. He can. I mean, I would be shocked if he doesn't end up in Dallas personally. I know Rick Bonus has been coaching them well, and they're on a good streak, but Gerard Gallant's a great coach. So we'll see. I don't think he's, even if the Ducks, you know, call on that, I don't think he's going there.
Yeah, we got into
flip the question around though. Should they target him?
Yes.
Wow, you're the biggest Dallas Eagles supporter, and you're the guy who keeps saying, oh, we need to wait at least a decade to know how good he'll be. You know.
I can at least identify when there's a better coach on the market, and I think that
the hot dog vendor sneezed during the power play, and so that's why they're not good. They're distracted.
That is what
it's
I
not
have
the
said.
Coaching.
That is what I have said. Wow, wow! Just throwing that bus on top of me that shouldn't be there. Wow.
I'm sorry.
But Gerard Gallant is. We talked about this on the Patreon episode, so if you really want our in-depth look on this, go take a look at that episode, subscribe to the channel, or become a patron at the $5 tier, and you can hear us talk about this for a good 10-20 minutes and what Gerard Gallant should do, kind of what we think about him as a head coach.
I was being persnickety there. Persnickety. Clearly. It's a good word. Persnickety.
And Tony asked also, what the hell is he supposed to do for 10 days until the Ducks play again? So, I think this is a good enough time for us to mention that I think what we're planning on doing for next week is we're going to almost do Patreon-style episodes on here. And so for those of you that are patrons, you're still going to get your episodes on there. You're still going to get your second episode of the month on there.
We might just do one continuous hour of questions.
That also could be what we do. But we're going to do podcasts next week. We believe that we're looking at Sunday and then potentially not set in stone, but potentially Wednesday on top of that. So for questions, for us talking about whatever we want to talk about. And so it's going to be more so like our Patreon episode. So for those of you out there that have been tempted to become patrons, to listen to those episodes, to see what they're like, the next week's episodes will kind of give you a taste for what those will be like. So it's going to be a real fun time, and I'm excited because the Patreon episodes are very, very exciting, or very, very fun, I think, for us to do, because you and I just get to really kind of talk
just
for a moment.
Tee off.
Yeah, and so this is Sunday the 19th, and I believe we're looking at 1 p.m. So if you want to tune in live, we will be on live. So it will be fun. It's going to be a good time. We're going to talk about whatever we want to talk about. We might talk Star Wars. We might talk Ducks. We might talk NHL as a whole. There's going to be a whole lot of things going on. Lewis is going to try to convince you to talk about basketball, it seems. Maybe we'll even talk about the Astros a little bit.
Ooh.
Lewis had a question about that earlier, saying how many times are the Astro players going to get hit in Anaheim? Because I believe, don't quote me on this, I believe the first game of the season for both the Astros and the Angels is at the Big A.
Let me ask you this. Are you team vacate the title?
Yes.
Okay.
Would you like?
Yeah.
Are you on that stance also?
I wasn't a few days ago, and then Buzzergate happened.
Oh,
and now I'm team vacate
see,
the title.
Here's my reasoning for it. Even before Buzzergate, once you continually cheat throughout the season, that makes that season not matter basically anymore. And yes, maybe you cheat one or two games. Maybe you just vacate those wins. But if you did it continually throughout the year, those games are null and void from a global perspective. So even if they didn't do it in the playoffs, the fact they didn't in the regular season, that season is null and void. That season is canceled for them, essentially. So they should not be able to win the title. It's that plain and simple. You cheated. You broke the rules. That needs to be done. By the way, what is your take on the fact that no players were suspended?
I don't know. This is where we're stretching my care of this.
Fair.
Baseball.
So yeah,
it's still baseball after all.
It looks like the season opener for the Astros and Angels. Sorry, it's actually at Minute Maid Park on the 26th, but I believe it's the Angels' home opener is against the Astros. Let me see real quick. Yes, it will be on Friday, April 3rd. So it's the Angels' home opener will be against the Astros. So that's gonna be entertaining to watch. I saw CJ tweet out something that Dodgers fans are potentially going to try to go to the game just to boo the heck out of Astros, the Astros players?
It's going to be a rough season for them.
Oh, they're going to get booed everywhere. Just wait till they go to New York for the first time.
Oh, yeah. Rough.
But, yep. So I think that's going to do it for the night. I'm not really seeing a whole lot more questions. But, yeah, make sure to keep an eye out for the We Are Live tweet for if you follow and if you follow us or subscribe to us on Twitch. And also, I do want to give a shout out to Lewis, who resubscribed for 16 months. Literical, our great friend Bonnie, resubscribed for 16 months. And Varluna also resubscribed for 13 months. So some people have been with us for a long time, basically since the beginning of this Twitch stream. Some of them even from before when we used to do this on Mixlr. That was a long time ago at this point. I'm happy I don't have to say that name anymore because it used to confuse me how to say it.
Mixlr? Mixlr?
Mixlr. Yeah.
Anyway.
There you go. But keep an eye out. It's going to be a real fun time.
Absolutely. So, on that note, we're going to wrap up today's show. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. You know where to go, but I'm going to reiterate it here. Like Jake already talked about, like we've been talking about this whole time, patreon.com/acpod. $1 a month, you get access to our patron-only chat. $5 a month, you get access to 2 bonus episodes, which are a lot of fun, and you're going to get to see why when we do that this upcoming week. On top of that, if you don't want to pay anything, if you just want to keep up with the free content, that's absolutely fine, totally understandable. One way to support the show that takes absolutely no time, just a couple minutes, and is a permanent contribution, leave a podcast rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Helps us a lot just to know how we're doing. And also, it's just it helps us climb those rankings.
Yep.
So definitely go check that out. We're also on Spotify, Stitcher, and we're on YouTube.
And I did want to mention that we got another review from Australia this past week. Said, keep on trucking, 5 stars. Super work, fellas. Show is awesome and full of great content. Another listener from Oz. That's Tony Ja versus Tong Po who wins. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot. We really do appreciate it. And hope everything is... I haven't really been tracking Australia, but hoping things are...
Supposedly that they just got a massive rainstorm, which has helped stop some of the rain or stop some of the fires. But hopefully, just like we said last week, hopefully you're doing good. Hopefully everything's safe. And shout out to all of our Australia listeners because our last 2 reviews have been from there. So thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, make sure to check out AnaheimCalling.com at AnaheimCalling on Twitter. Jake is on Twitter at ReindeerGames91. Make sure, I just want you to do this. If you're going to do any of the things I just talked about, when Jake tweets about wrestling, just reply wrestling tweet. Because every time I say on the show that Jake tweets about wrestling, he disputes it. And lately, he's just...
It has been a high volume lately, I'll give you that.
He's been tweeting more about wrestling than hockey.
Hey, one of them was really good, though, of late, and I thought it was very, very clever of me, the fact that the Royal Rumble is not this weekend, but next weekend, and it's at the Astros ballpark. Someone has to troll Astros fans.
You're going to a WWE event, I am
going to NXT Live in Riverside for my birthday.
So if you're going to be there, if you're a listener who's also a wrestling fan... Which is an interesting cross-section.
Hey, we have some.
Yeah.
There are some.
Hit up Jake.
We have had
hit up Jake.
Remember, we had someone ask us about Wrestle Kingdom? What was my favorite match from Wrestle Kingdom? That was a thing.
I don't know what any of that just
New
meant.
New Japan
cool.
Pro Wrestling.
Still lost. Still
Japanese
lost at
wrestling.
Sea. Okay. Sumo wrestling.
No. Japanese wrestling.
Alrighty. By the way, UFC 246 tomorrow night. I will be watching.
Who you got?
Which fight?
Which fight does everyone care about?
I don't know. Holly Holm. Holly Holm is got a good bout. No, come on. Yeah, Conor McGregor. He's back.
Who?
All controversy aside, fighting Cowboy Cerrone. You know it's tough. Conor hasn't won in 3 years, so it's kind of hard to pick him. But I think there's a reason he's fighting Cowboy Cerrone. I think there's a reason they're doing it at this weight. And I think it's all to stack the deck in his favor. I think he's going to knock him out in the first 3 rounds. There's my prediction.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think he's going to pummel him, personally.
Wait, sorry. It's who did you say I was looking at our Twitch chat?
Maybe I didn't say it specifically, but Connor's going to win.
Oh, okay.
I'm feeling pretty good about that. Because the thing is, Cerrone is a great wrestler, but he doesn't use it. And he doesn't seem... everything he's said so far is I'm not going to wrestle.
Maybe he should go and wrestle in a professional wrestling league then.
The one big advantage he has over Connor, he's not going to use. So I think he's just happy to be here and collect the biggest check of his career. That's fine.
Yeah, I'll probably watch it. I'll probably watch it.
It's going to be a good night, though. It's a decent card. I mean, if you're a fight fan, I recommend it. And we've got the conference championships in football on Sunday. So it's going to be a pretty packed weekend sports-wise. I'm excited.
Mm-hmm.
My couch will be put to good use.
Yeah. How you feeling? Real quick before we wrap up, how you feeling about your Niners with the chance to go to the Super Bowl?
I mean, I haven't checked the stats, but they should be Super Bowl favorites at this point.
Wow. Bold.
I mean, they're playing a good Packers team, but they are at home.
Bold.
And I don't know. Titans, Chiefs, it's going to be interesting. So, yeah, I'm feeling great.
It's going to be
feeling good.
Chiefs
feeling
are probably going to win it.
The whole thing?
Yeah.
What?
Making my prediction.
You're not picking the Titans? How dare you?
And I'm definitely not picking your Niners because I know you'll just gloat.
No, I'm a jaded Niners fan where I've experienced utter defeat, so I try not to get too excited.
Yeah.
You know, I've tasted some pretty sour defeats in recent years, so I don't get too ahead of myself. You know, it's part of being a sports fan. You don't want to jinx it, even though it has absolutely no effect on the outcome.
Yeah. So this has kind of turned into a Patreon episode for the end of it. So yeah, there's a little teaser for you for what you're gonna get on Sunday.
There you go. All right, folks, thanks for listening, and we will talk to you soon. Thanks a lot.
Bye.